Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us this morning. During his testimony before Congress yesterday, General David Petraeus stated that security progress in Iraq has been significant but uneven. In this hour, our guests will discuss troop levels, recent violence in Basra and other parts of the country, Iran, and the congressionally mandated benchmarks that define testimony last September. We begin with Bruce Gentleson, who is a professor at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. And Professor Gentleson, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
In the second half hour of the show, Professor Robert Olson, who is in Middle East politics at the University of Kentucky, will share his views on the testimony yesterday before Congress. Let me ask you for your overall reaction to as the day unfolded.
Well, I think that General Petraeus and the troops are doing the best job possible, and they're doing it with courage and commitment and bravery. The problem is the mission that they're being asked to do is fundamentally flawed. Stabilizing Iraq internally and containing its effects on the rest of the region is just not doable through a largely military strategy, even with the ways that Petraeus has improved what had come before.
So there then appears to be no end in sight for the military objectives and the political objectives as laid out yesterday.
I don't think this strategy will work. I think that the success that we saw, you know, over the first 6 to 9 months, maybe 12 months, was important. But in many respects, it was kind of like the economic bubble that we've been going through. It really had the seeds of its own failure, because in many of the ways we were paying attention only to security on the ground and not to the underlying political elements. The way to avoid a worst case scenario and an outright failure of this whole effort is to shift strategy from the military surge to what I view as a diplomatic surge.
I heard that term used frequently yesterday, that we need a diplomatic surge over the next 9 months or so.
That's right. And that means I was engaged in some discussions to which a Bush administration official responded, well, we're doing diplomacy. I think they're doing diplomacy with very, very little effort, hardly anything one would call a surge. To be honest with you, there is no guarantee, given that the hole that the Bush administration has dug us into, that Iraq will come out well. That's the reality of the invasion that the Bush administration did in 2003 and the policies they've pursued so far. The best way to avoid the worst-case scenario, and things can be a lot worse than they are today, both for the Iraqi people and the region, there's no question about it,
mm-hmm.
but the best way is to shift strategy. A military strategy is not going to succeed in stabilizing Iraq because there are fundamental political issues both within Iraq and in the region that this strategy, even with a commander like General Petraeus, just can't get at.
You wrote a blog or a column in the newsobserver.com on the 1st of April that talked about warning signs in Iraq in three fundamental flaws that pointed to the unsustainability of the surge. And let's just go through those 3 points, leading with the enemy of my enemy may still be my enemy as well.
That's right. That's an old adage that, you know, people talk about going back to World War II when mm-hmm. FDR and Churchill allied with Stalin against Hitler, said the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And oftentimes it works that way. And in some ways, that's what we did with the alliance we've been striking with the Sunni tribes, so the so-called Anbar Awakening, where the common enemy there is al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so we have allied with them, and much of the success of the surge has been damping down that violence, because the Sunnis also weren't particularly pro-American or hardly pro-Shiite, but the terrorism of al-Qaeda in Iraq was aimed at them and their people. The problem with this is that as long as we have that shared threat, this alliance of convenience between our forces and the Sunni tribes can come together. But over time, the question is going to be not just al-Qaeda in Iraq. This is fundamentally a civil war. And the Anbar Awakening of Sunni tribes have very different interests in terms of what their interests are, in terms of, you know, what they have to lose with the Shiites, than we do in bringing everybody together. And so what you find in that situation is the enemy of my enemy over time may still be my enemy too. And so the short-term benefits of this alliance with the tribes helped against one aspect of Iraq, which is the Al-Qaeda terrorists. But basing a strategy on that, again, reminds me of, you know, to draw an analogy in the economic sector, ways in which a lot of people got short-term returns on their investments over the last 5 years, and then the bubble burst on them.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as militias, the Shiite Mahdi and Badr militias laid low for a while, but they certainly haven't gone away, and there's concentrated fighting dealing with those militias right now.
Yeah, it's, you know, not only those militias, but the Sunni militias, the ones we've been arming with the Sunni tribes, giving them weapons, along with the militias that were never disbanded and we saw explode last week, frankly, at the snap of the fingers of their leader, Muqtada al-Sadr. It is a basic, you know, fact, frankly, today, anywhere you look in the world and historically, that you can never create a stable government of any kind if you have armed militias running around the country. It's happening in Lebanon. It ultimately happened in Afghanistan. And here, too, you know, even with the Sunni militias, the ones that we call friends now, do we really think they're going to give the guns back after al-Qaeda in Iraq is defeated? And so the notion that we're trying to leave a stable system in Iraq while the militias continue, again, looking down the road just a little bit, is fundamentally has its own contradiction.
The surge was intended to give the Iraqi government time to get its act together and to take charge in the country. Bush administration making much of a number of bills recently passed by the Iraqi legislature. What's your view of what has happened there?
That was progress compared to what came before. But when you scratch the surface of a number of those bills, you saw that it was more kind of papering over the cracks than building solid political foundations. There's a lot of American pressure from the embassy and others to get some things done. But the staying power, you know, if you're going to build a political house, as it were, you need to lay a solid foundation. And these bills, particularly put in the context of 4 or 5 years, of efforts to try to make political progress, not just the last year of the surge, are very, very limited. And they really haven't done anything about some fundamentals that Iraq or any society needs, like the rule of law, delivering basic services like electricity, gasoline, water supply. And so because this strategy has been so military and only very, very limited political and diplomatic, we have not built that foundation on which ultimately the House needs to rest.
Our guest is Bruce Gentleson, who is a professor at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we're using the Madison numbers, 263-1890 in Madison, or toll-free at 800-642-1234, and our email address, talk@wpr.org. Were you surprised in General Petraeus urging this 45-day halt in weighing any new Iraq troop cuts once the surge forces have been brought home?
No, they had been previewing that in the Bush administration, calling it a pause. But if you contrast General Petraeus's testimony yesterday in September, the argument was, we are finally making progress. Don't pull the plug on us. We need to build on that progress. Now, in April, the argument is, well, we aren't making that much progress, but we need to continue until we do. And so what we really have here is saying there's only one strategy we can pursue, unwilling this administration to consider others. You know, you look at the recent data, attacks in Iraq, which were down to 239 in February, were up to 631 in March. Here in North Carolina, in the small town of Rocky Mount, one small National Guard unit that's based there has had three National Guardsmen killed just in the last 2 weeks. So even this notion of short-term progress is being really questioned by the recent data. If this administration, you know, were to genuinely put its American talent, resources, commitment, prestige behind an alternative strategy, which is not just based on a calendar of withdrawal, but is based on a strategy of shifting to this diplomatic surge, we would have a better chance. No promises made, but I really think a better chance of avoiding the worst-case scenario in Iraq than continuing on the path they have us on.
Now, General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker were facing three candidates for the White House, two Democrats and a Republican. And what did you sense from the testimony or the questioning of Senator McCain, Clinton, and Obama?
I think the American people are going to be given a real choice when we get to the general election. Senator McCain himself has said, basically, my candidacy almost collapsed last year because I was so associated with Iraq policy. That was one of the reasons. Part of its reason for a comeback, I mean, there are other political ones, was the sense, particularly among Republicans, the surge was going better. And he has said, you know, the general election, this will be a big issue. And he is lined up squarely behind more of the same. Whoever wins the Democratic nomination is calling for a shift in strategy. And like elections are supposed to be, there will be a clear choice for the American people. Obviously, other issues will enter into their choices, but on Iraq, we will have a choice between whether it's Senator Clinton or Senator Obama, a fundamental shift in strategy, or more of the same with Senator McCain.
We're talking with Bruce Gentleson, who is a professor at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. And we'll take your calls in just a moment. We have two lines open if you have questions or comments about testimony by General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker yesterday before Congress. And the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we continue talking with our first guest, Bruce Gentleson, professor at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. And let's take some phone calls, Professor, and we'll start with Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill. What's on your mind today?
Good morning. Interesting presentations yesterday. Interesting discussion. I've had one question that I've posed a few times before to guests on this show and others, and that is the reliability of the Johns Hopkins survey estimate of 600,000, I think, mean number of dead Iraqi civilians. And what's always been left out of the surge discussion is either using that number, or, I'm sorry, the after the surge or after the our withdrawal, the whole withdrawal debate, is what would happen to the Iraqi civilian population with any concreteness. And I see this as being avoided by the American press, perhaps I just haven't read far enough, and by certainly by our presidential candidates. And this is a huge, I think, outlying liability that's going to haunt us for a very long time. And will stir many memories of the failure and success of this war, almost irrespectively at this point of what we do. But the idea of it growing to a million or perhaps a million more, is it's really scared the bejesus out of me for a whole number of reasons, which I'm sure you can fill in yourself. I'd like your response on that.
Sure. The civilians, you're absolutely right, both as a matter of policy and principle, that Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, when he was trying to explain why we shouldn't invade Iraq, had what he called his pottery barn theory. You know, if you break it, it's yours. And we do have a moral responsibility to the Iraqi people. My concern is that the policy we're pursuing of continued, large military operations is more likely, not less likely, to lead to those worst-case scenarios you're talking about. Civilian deaths, the Johns Hopkins numbers, I know, have been disputed by some. But even if you just take the numbers used by the Defense Department, civilian deaths in Iraq were up 43% last month to 472. When I talk about a worst-case scenario, the real debate, you know, sometimes people say, well, if we stay in, maybe we'll succeed, maybe we won't. If we withdraw, you know, everything's going to break loose. That would be true if we withdraw, have to withdraw, you know, precipitously, because everything's collapsing. The argument for an alternative strategy, working, you know, really at the global level with all of the other major countries, at the including the UN, at the regional level with the key countries like Turkey and Jordan, Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia, and everybody working together the best we can with a combination of carrots and sticks to move the Iraqi Shiite, Sunnis, and Kurds towards as much political reconciliation as possible, is to try to avoid that scenario. As I said before, there are no guarantees in this situation. It's pretty awful. But I do believe fundamentally that we're more likely to avoid humanitarian disaster in Iraq by shifting strategy to one that really heavily emphasizes diplomacy and carrots and sticks than one that continues to emphasize more and more military operations.
A quick follow-up on that. Why do you think the press in general and the candidates have been avoiding it for a year? The press has avoided it assiduously of discussing the implications of it.
I don't know that the candidates have. I think if you look, you know, at the kinds of policies that Senators Obama and Clinton, and not just them, frankly, you know, a lot of what you see in policy comes from various think tanks that work on both sides of the aisle. And if you look at reports by groups like the Center for American Progress, or a group that's called Responsible Plan, that a number of candidates working with the National Security Network have signed on to, you see people addressing this. In some respects, you know, the press, you're right, you know, it's a little bit like the criticism of the press on the election. They give us horse race and not substance. And they kind of hear they give us, you know, an account that doesn't look at these things. But there is attention being paid to it. In a serious way, and if there is a shift in administration, and I am a Democrat, as is probably obvious, I actually think it will be taken very seriously by this by a new administration. It will not be, we're getting out, we don't care. It will be, what's the best way, you know, to get out for American interests and to ensure regional containment and as much internal stabilization as possible.
Bill, thank you so much for your call this morning. Appreciate hearing from you. Adam, what can we do for you today?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the program and thank your guest in particular. I think he is taking a viewpoint that comes from sort of what a potential Democratic administration might do. I have a concern that neither his viewpoint nor the continue the surge type viewpoint really want to face up to the most likely outcomes, excluding the bloodbath, the most likely outcome of a state that was artificial to begin with. And I have to tell you that I am a trained historian, and my specialty is Third World Revolutionary Movements. The boundaries of modern Iraq were drawn right after World War One. They were artificial to begin with. President Wilson's people himself had recommended an independent Kurdistan in between Turkey and Iraq. The point is here that Senator Biden came the closest by acknowledging that, in effect, Iraq as a state is going to be, at best, if it's held together, three states. It's going to be a very large and strong Shiite part with one more than half the oil fields, connected very closely to Iran by religion, history, common interests. The losers will be the Sunnis who don't live in the oil areas, and they, by the way, should have been part of Saudi Arabia to begin with after World War One. The third part is going to be a Kurdish area that, no matter what anyone wants to say, is on a decades-long plan to create an independent Kurdistan. Their leadership is capable and good and so forth, and they may stay with a weak central government in Iraq. The United States does not want this because of, obviously, the Shiite-Iranian tie and nationalist control over the oil fields. And I think the effective division of the country, whether or not it stays together on paper, raises up seismic possibilities in a region where most of the boundary lines are totally artificial. So I think the problem is not so much the bloodbath that the focus is being talked about, but the fact that the U.S. policymakers on both sides of the aisle don't want to accept the most probable outcome, and they're trying to figure out a way to prevent it.
Yeah, I understand the historical argument. There's a lot of validity to it. It's, you know, it's, I'm sure it's, you know better than I. It's made in Africa as well about some of the problems there. We can't go back and redraw the lines. I don't think that that's going to happen. It's interesting to me that among the various positions taken by, you know, the three major groups in Iraq, we have not been hearing a lot of argument for either, you know, dividing into three independent states or the like. None of the groups, not the Shiites, not the Sunnis, and not the Iraqi Kurds, have been making that argument. In terms of the Shiites in Iraq and Iran, you know, we need to deal with the Iran issue in and of itself. And, you know, I am of the view there, too, that the administration has pursued a flawed policy that's made the problem worse, hardly better. And so I think that, the Biden plan and others, you know, if the parties like, were calling for partition themselves, as with Yugoslavia when it split into independent states, it might make sense for the United States to support that. But that is not the position of the parties. And I think for us to try to, push that, impose that, whatever the historical argument, I think would not solve the problems.
Thank you so much, Adam, for your call and for your thoughts. And I know that you have business ahead, and so we appreciate your being with us for some time this morning. Thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. That was Bruce Gentleson, who is a professor at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy at Duke University. And if you'd like to read what he had to say on the 1st of April, quite perceptive, go to newsobserver.com. And in there, under columns, Bruce Gentleson, Gentleson, the title of the article, Diminishing Returns. He's saying, for these and other reasons, the surge is at best at its point of diminishing returns. Little more can be achieved, and much is at risk by continued massive American military presence in Iraq. We need to shift from a military to diplomatic surge. This means drawing down our troops carefully, responsibly, strategically, while building up our diplomatic initiatives globally, regionally, and within Iraq. The goals remain the same: as much internal stabilization as possible and regional containment of the conflict from drawing in and spreading to other states. But the strategy needs to change. As with the American economy, short-term successes in Iraq have come without building the foundations for sustainable gains, indeed in some respects weakening those foundations even further. As bad as the economic crisis is in this country and around the world, the bursting of the Iraq bubble would be much worse. The thoughts of Bruce Gentleson. And in just a moment, we'll be talking with our second guest, Robert Olson, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Kentucky, as we continue to look at the testimony yesterday by General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker before the Senate Armed Services Committee and other committees of the Senate. The two are appearing today before the House, and there will be more about that in a special broadcast tonight at 6 o'clock, which will recap the testimony there. Let's take Robert Olson, bring him into the conversation. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim.
Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
We'll go back to the telephone. Well, first of all, let me just ask you about your thoughts reflecting upon yesterday's testimony by Petraeus and Crocker.
Well, it's what those of us who are Middle East specialists rather expected. I mean, it's entirely in the context of the presidential elections. Obviously, Petraeus and Crocker are both supporting the administrative's position, and they were pretty much noncommittal on every single question of significance in terms of what's going on in Iraq. And you could hardly expect them to say otherwise, I guess, given the fact that not only John McCain, but Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were in attendance or will be in attendance today at their talk. So there was very little information there for the American public, given the crucial significance of Iraq in terms of not just the election, but for the whole future of American foreign policy over the next decades.
Let's take some calls, and if you'd like to join in, there are a couple lines open in Madison. It's 263-1890, elsewhere 800-642-1234, as we talk with Professor Robert Olson of the University of Kentucky. And let us go next to Stephen in Madison. Stephen, what's on your mind today?
It's just one little small chapter in this big story of United States domination of the world. I think we have to put ourselves in the shoes of a European during the Nazi takeover, attempted takeover of the planet. The United States, with its 800 military bases and its fleets and its projected Star Wars aggressive capacity up in space, the world is, we are all in great danger from this military virus. And if one good purpose could be served by the suffering of the people of the Middle East, they could be breaking the back of U.S. power. And that would be the best thing all of us could ever anticipate. If we rein in these ridiculous generals with the confetti on their damn uniforms and put them on trial for war crimes. I mean, the civilian leadership of this country, they should be executed for their crimes of 9/11 and for the subsequent oil wars. Thank you very much.
All right, Stephen. A reaction to that?
For me?
Yes.
I'm in somewhat accord with what he has said. There's no question about that this is a colonializing experience on the part of the United States. It certainly is hopefully one of the last imperialist thrust of American power. And that's why I think it's so controversial within the political and economic elite within the within the United States. When you talk about, for example, in the Petraeus's and Crocker's testimony today and before, what you're basically talking about is how to make the American colonization of Iraq more effective. Other than, of course, those people recommending withdrawal. Of course, withdrawal, even withdrawal, of course, is a very long-term, not a long-term, but it would take two, even if you made the decision today to withdraw the 150,000 American troops or 160,000 American troops, plus we have to withdraw another 30 to 40,000 Iraqis and foreign workers who are collaborating with the United States. And then you have to withdraw 60,000 contractors who work with the United States. So we're talking close to 400,000 people that have to be extracted from Iraq. And that would take an extremely long time given all of the airplanes, tanks, military equipment in Iraq. So the question has to be, why does the American government persist, given what the caller has just indicated? And I think that the reason has to be, of course, is the significance of oil. Most people say that there's 115 billion barrels of proven oil reserves in Iraq, but many Middle Eastern specialists think that indeed it may be up to 200. And if the international gas and oil companies, with the United States participating, would be able to be the dominant factor in access to these oil and gas reserves, which include, of course, Central Asia as well, then that would give the international gas and oil companies, American companies playing a predominant role, utilize the profits from that to buy up the non-fossil fuels as well. These international gas and oil companies are very broad and diverse companies, and so they're also heavily engaged in the non-fossil fuels. But this will take probably $10 trillion or $15 trillion to make this transition over the next 20 or 30 years, or partial transition, and a lot of the funds to do this, the economic elite would like to have that funded by the energy resources in the Middle East. So there is a lot at stake here. I think what is important for the American people to consider is whether to what profit that they would receive, you know, from this in terms of cheaper energy or other alternative sources of energy. And I suspect that it would it would not be very much. And you have to balance that off against the tremendous destruction in Iraq. As the caller indicated, you've had 1 million deaths. So a lot of it, of course, because of internecine Iraqi fighting, but underneath the aegis of American occupation, and probably up to 200,000 killed, and then some cities have completely destroyed, almost like Fallujah, good portions of Haditha, Ramadi, certain sections of Baquba, and all the small towns along the Syrian border have been blown to smithereens. So one thing that is not asked in these discussions going on in the United States Congress, which the caller alluded to, is, of course, the moral situation. I mean, even if the American people, even the middle class or lower class, were to receive some kind of trickle-down advantage in terms of energy and so forth, does that offset the destruction which is being done in Iraq? And also, by the way, it seems that the average American person will not receive that much from whatever success that is in terms of the colonialization of Iraq will receive. We see that grocery prices are going up, energy prices are going up for home heating and gasoline. Here in the state of Kentucky, for example, just before you called, we saw that the tuition is going to be raised 9% at the university. There will be no faculty and staff raises probably for 1 or 2 years. And part of this, certainly I would never argue all, but a portion of this is due to the Iraq War and to the cost of the war and the proliferation of those costs throughout our economy. So that would be my response.
All right. Majid in Madison, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hello, sir. I'm calling from my cell phone, so I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, we can.
You know, I'm kind of disappointed about our Middle Eastern policy. We do not have a long-term comprehensive policy toward Middle East. And what we are doing is so short-sighted. We try to extinguish one fire after another one without looking at the whole picture. For example, when Iran and Iraq were fighting, we sided with Saddam and gave him lots of arms. Later on, we had to go and take care of Saddam. Now, at the same time, we are giving lots of arms and ammunition to the Sunnis, and then we are asking Shias to put their arms down. And remember that when after the American takeover of Iraq, lots of Shia mosque was being destroyed. And now we are telling them, okay, wait a minute, let us arm those people and you put your arms down. Do you think they listen? What is the wisdom of arming one faction over another one and keep doing that, and we are not getting any lesson from history of what has happened?
Professor?
Well, the wisdom of it is, from the American government's point of view, as I mentioned earlier in my talk, is to assume as much control over Iraq as possible. And if you can just take example of what has occurred in the last couple of weeks. You know, Vice President Cheney was in Iraq just about 3 or 4 days before the Iraqi government, before the Maliki government, pushed by the Americans, or compelled, you might say, by the Vice President of the United States to attack the Muqtada al-Sadr's forces in the southern part of Iraq. And the reason to do this was to defeat the Sadrists so that they would not have a good chance of obtaining victory in the elections in October. You have provincial elections in October. If that would be the case, then the Iraqi Supreme Council, which is the major party in the government of Iraq, and the major ally of the Nouri al-Maliki government, would lose power. and the Sadrists get stronger. The Sadrists are more Iraqi nationalists, and it's quite possible that they would have even greater reconciliation with some of the Sunni groups, although they don't want too much reconciliation. So the United States wanted to prevent that because the United States wants to bounce all of these forces out. That's why they renewed their relationship with the Sunni forces after they were fighting them the last year and a half. And then they hope that the second reason is they hope to strengthen the Baghdad government's military power. They want to increase its coercive power so that it would be hold the major source of coercive power in Iraq vis-a-vis the militias, whether they be Sunni or Shia. They can't do much with the Kurds because the Kurds are basically autonomous. They have about 120,000 army, they call it. They don't even call them a militia. And they are controlling the three areas of Iraq, which are autonomous, and portions of other four areas, which are adjacent to the Kurdish area. But the United States needs the Kurds as an ally. So the whole operation currently of Petraeus and of Crocker in Iraq is to subdue those forces, which are in opposition to the Maliki government, to strengthen the Maliki government, to build up the military under his power up to maybe 300 or 400,000, and then this will be able to control Iraq. This is, for example, what John McCain, who is the great supporter of Petraeus and of Crocker, says: we want to reduce the number of Americans who are killed. After all, if there are fewer Americans killed, Iraq even recedes more in the minds of the American Republic, especially with its economic downturn, and then they will be able to get control of the oil resources. You have to remember that one reason for the fighting in the Shia areas of Iraq now is because those three provinces in the southern part of Iraq, Basra, Mosanna, and Zakar, have 75% of the current oil production of Iraq. The other 25% or so comes from the Kirkuk fields, which are contested between the Iraqi government and the Kurds. If you can get, remove the Sadrists, and you can remove the Fadala party, which also controls these three provinces, bring it under the control of the Iraqi government, then you can increase the amount of the inflow of oil, which this year is $60 billion. It could be easily gotten up to $100 billion. Then it would pay for the war, and it would pay for the Iraqi oil funds would pay for the American occupation of Iraq, and that's the aim of the United States.
Thank you, Majid, for bringing that up. Appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Robert Olson, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Kentucky. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today as we continue talking about events in Iraq, the testimony from General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker yesterday before committees of the United States Senate. They are back again today on Capitol Hill talking to the House of Representatives. Our guest to talk about events is Robert Olson, professor of Middle East politics at the University of Kentucky. Again, thank you, sir, for being with us this morning. Before we go back to the phones, let me ask you about this. You mentioned Cheney's visit to al-Maliki just a couple of days before the invasion there in Basra. Mm-hmm. I was struck by something I heard on a news account that Basra was sort of the capital of black market oil in Iraq, and that was one strong reason why they were going in and trying to defeat the forces of El Sadr.
That's true. As I've said, there is another party that you don't hear much about in the press, and that is called the Fadala Party or the Virtue Party, and it also has an Ayatollah which is for it. They also want the decentralization of Iraq, much like, for example, the Supreme Consul of Iraq wants, which is, of course, affiliated with Iran. But they differ from the Sadrists in that even though they're all Shia, that they're not as pro-Iraqi nationalist that in terms of having a unified state as the Sadrists are. So they fund a lot of their militias and their government. After all, they are the running the hospitals, the schools, and everything else through selling of oil. And some of that, of course, is smuggled. Some of it is smuggled through Iran. Some is smuggled other places. No question about that. So, of course, the Iraqi government, of course, the American and the Iraqi government wanted to staunch this smuggling of oil, because if they cut off their funds, then it would be easier to defeat militarily. You're absolutely right.
All right, let's go back to Lance in Birchwood. Hello, Lance.
Good morning. I served over in Iraq right after the fall of, well, if you call it a fall of Baghdad, and our mission was, it had changed four different times as we were over there. But one of the things that I noticed as we were over there, and I think maybe some people are missing the point on this, is that, you know, we talk so much about military action, and we talk so much about the military operations over there. I can tell you, when I was over there, you know, third country nationals were given preferential treatment over the indigenous Iraqi civilians. And, you know, and I feel like it much could be accomplished, and we talked about that diplomatic surge I heard a while back,
mm-hmm.
Much could be accomplished by putting the Iraqis to work. And I guess I can understand or empathize on one side that they are... What do they have to look forward to when they wake up in the morning? Do they look forward to having a job of rebuilding their country, or do they look forward of maybe not coming home at night, from whatever militia that is there? So, you know, I guess my point is that, you know, instead of maybe focusing on, you know, military operations, maybe we should maybe try to focus on putting the Iraqis to work and to rebuild their communities. And, you know, we've seen it here in the United States where we've rebuilt communities, and the communities take on a life of their own, and pretty soon the crime goes down, and pretty soon the bad guys leave, and now we've got a sustainable community. And trust me, I've been all over that country, and the Kurds, it's funny, up in the north in Kurdish territory, they have open-air markets. People, you know, are not afraid to go out at night. They're very content people. But it seems as though when the further south you go, that the more problems arise. And there's something to that. And it's because the Kurds took charge of their area, and they said, we are not going to allow the militias to be here. We're not going to allow all this violence that's going to go on here. We're going to make sure that our community sustains. And it is. It's very beautiful up north. And so I find it just really ironic that, you know, we talk about military operations, whether we should just be saying, you know what, can we do for the civilians to get them on their feet?
Professor?
Well, yes. Let me take Kurdistan first, which... I was just in October and November, I was along the border of Turkey with Syria and Iraq, and I was just in Turkey 2 weeks ago, and I got back having to do with the situation in northern Iraq. I agree completely with what the caller has said, but let me just contextualize his comments. The first is that Kurdistan is doing well because they allied with the United States from 19th of March 2003 up to the present. United States poured billions of dollars into there. There's now scores. There's tens of thousands of different companies in Europe, including Turkish companies as well, who are operating throughout the northern Iraq. That's because they are collaborating with the United States. They're collaborating with the invasion of Iraq, and they're collaborating with the American colonization of Iraq, as long as the Kurdish-controlled areas remain under their control, which is another question that we can get to later. So, yes, I agree completely that should be the case. You know, some people, at one time there was over 100,000 foreign workers in Iraq. Now, according to the latest information, there's about 60,000 you know, Filipinos, Pakistanis, Indians, and so forth, working. And one of the reasons for this, my understanding is because a lot of these foreign contracting companies, with the agreement of the United States government and the occupation forces in Iraq, couldn't trust them.
That is, they may come in and blow this up or blow that up or suicide bombings and so forth. So that was the reason. But the consequence of that is, as the caller said, of course, you have extremely high unemployment. And undoubtedly, many people join the militias, young men particularly, who are unemployed. At least they can get their $200 or $300 a month, which is quite minimal given the inflation and everything else you have in Iraq. So the situation in Kurdistan has to be contextualized. And also remember that the situation in Kurdistan and the members of the Iraqi government in the Iraqi parliament from Kurdistan also, of course, raises problems with the Iraqi government because they want near complete autonomy. They want to have control over another province, which at the moment they control militarily but not legally, and that is the Kirkuk province, which also is a major oil-producing area of Iraq. About 25% of Iraq oil comes from this this field. In fact, is there supposed to be a referendum in Kirkuk as to whether or not they wanted to join the autonomous Kurdish regional government. The United States put pressure on the Kurds over the last year or so to postpone this referendum. In fact, is it may not even, it was supposed to occur in the spring now of 2008. It's quite possible that it won't occur at all. So there's a tremendous struggle between the Arabs, both Sunni and Shi'i in the government, and with the Kurdish government. And so the United States wants to make sure that the Kurdish government, the Kurdish regional government, is autonomous as possible in case you were to have some reconciliation between the Sunnis and Shi'is, which would be Iraqi Arab nationalism, then the United States has the option of putting its bases in Kurdistan. So there is a connection between the well-being of Kurdistan, which the caller as an American soldier saw, mm-hmm. and the political context in which this, of course, takes place.
Let me ask you, General Petraeus said the security situation in Iraq remains in flux in part because of the destructive role that Iran has played with its backing of special groups of Shiite radicals that he said now pose the greatest immediate threat in Iraq. What is the role that Iran is playing here?
Well, it's very controversial. It's a huge topic within those people who specialize in Iraq because, of course, almost all of the parties in Iraq, including the Kurds, in one way or another, have relations with Iran. Iran supports the Sadrists. They also have very good relations with the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, as well as other factions. And of course, undoubtedly, Iran has been the source, whether it's the government, whether it's the Revolutionary Guards, whether it's some other aspect of the government, because there are many different locations of government in Iran, of helping out the various kinds of militias in Iran. But also, saying that, it's also, of course, the United States' interest to say that that things would be much better for not for Iraq. This helps, of course, cover up some of the American failures, the inability to push for reconciliation among the various groups in Iraq. And it would be nice, of course, to blame Iran. Also, some specialists in the Middle East think that if things get even worse and if the United States government decides not to withdraw over a period of the next 2 or 3 years, then that leaves open for the United States to attack Iran, which has been very much of an issue the past year or so. I think Petraeus and Crocker would like to leave that option open. In the meanwhile, by stating this and ratcheting up the rhetoric once again against Iran, it increases the pressure upon Iran, whatever they're doing politically, let alone militarily, with their various support groups or allies within Iraq, to diminish that support. So Petraeus and Crocker have that objective.
Also, Senator Biden, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, repeatedly asked Ambassador Crocker about the security agreements with Iraq that are being negotiated by the administration and whether or not the Senate was going to have to sign off on this.
Well, it's an extremely important issue because these talks have been going on for well over a year, almost a year and a half, the status of force agreements. And of course, what this will do is regulate the American presidents, in Iraq for the foreseeable future. And to what extent these will be, I don't know. Crocker has said that this does not tie the United States to long-term commitment and so forth, but that's hardly believable. And also, I think many people are concerned with the fact that the status of force agreement will proceed to such an extent, especially if the United States compels the government in Baghdad to accept it, will pretty much determine the course, and there won't be much another president if it were to be Senator Clinton or Senator Obama. There's not much they'd be able to do about it. So over and above the argument of what to do in Iraq, whether to proceed with the situation, whether to have a timely withdrawal, whether to have a more precipitate withdrawal and a time period in which to do this. In addition to that, especially if we're a Democratic president, committed to a timely withdrawal from Iraq, it complicates the situation enormously, and I don't see how any of this could be unraveled within the next 4 years, even if there were to be a Democratic president. It'd be impossible.
We'll have to leave it there. I thank you so much for spending time with us this morning and look forward to visiting with you again.
It's my pleasure always to talk to the people of Wisconsin.
Thank you. Robert Olson, professor of Middle East politics at the University of Kentucky. Our thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show and to Carmen Jackson for on-air production. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.